Well, it's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night, and it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Let's start off with announcements. Right here in Santa Cruz, the Fungus Fair is going to be going on this weekend, January 9th and 10th. Come to Santa Cruz and visit the Kingdom of Fungi. Learn about the hundreds of beautiful and fascinating species of local fungi on display in a recreated woodland habitat. This unique Santa Cruz tradition features 2 days of fantastic fun with fungus for the whole family. The Santa Cruz Fungus Fair features a special room full of hands-on activities for the kids, including a fungus exploration area, clay mushroom building, face paints, and more. The 36th annual Santa Cruz Fungus Fair will be held at the Loudon Nelson Community Center. Sponsored by the Fungus Federation of Santa Cruz and the Santa Cruz Museum Association, the fair draws 2,000 or more visitors per year. Highlights this year will include lectures by prominent mycologists. Those are people who know all about fungi. And the basics of mushroom identification in our popular Mushrooms 101 class. Dr. Tom Volk, University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, a very popular and knowledgeable professional mycologist, will discuss the wonderful world of wild mushrooms. Learn about the medicinal properties of mushrooms from renowned herbalist Christopher Hobbs, and ask an expert to identify a mushroom from your backyard. Be sure to refrigerate it, otherwise they tend to fall apart before you can get there. Top chefs and mushroom epicures Jack Sarnecki of the Joel Palmer House and Joseph Schultz, formerly of India Joe's, who will provide amazing cooking demonstrations that will be sure to thrill your palate. Children will enjoy many hands-on activities in the kids' room, and vendors will be selling books, mushrooms, and other related mushroom items and fungal food. When's it going to be happening? From 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday and Sunday? Adults $7, museum and federation members $6, seniors and students $5, kids under 12 free. Want to go both days? $12 or $10 if you're a current museum and federation member. The Fungus Fair. Check it out at Loudon Nelson Center this weekend. And the California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team will be having their bi-monthly restoration this Saturday, January 9th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Aña Nueva Reserve and Cascade Creek Watershed. What a splendid way to start the new year. Join our team volunteers and San Mateo Audubon birders assisting State Parks environmental scientists in collecting and planting willow cuttings to help restore valuable North Coast habitat. Restoring this drainage helps improve habitat for local and migrant songbirds, a host of invertebrate species, as well as a refuge for small rodents, snakes, and lizards, and don't forget the elephant seals after the event. It's a perfect time of year to check them out, too. Normally, I don't want or require an RSVP for projects, but this time, you're going to have to call. That's right, folks. If you want to go out and do this restoration this weekend at Aña Nueva Reserve and Cascade Creek Watershed, you need to give Linda a call. Her number, 462-4041. That's 462-4041. And the reason is that they're going to have to vanpool. So, please note, due to parking constraints at the project site, we will meet at Wilder Ranch and vanpool to the site. To get to Wilder, take Highway 1 north from Santa Cruz and turn off on the left-hand side for Wilder Ranch. There are signs indicating the turn. Once you go through the kiosk, meet us at the interpretive sign by the bathrooms in the upper use parking lot. And once again, that's Highway 1 North to Wilder Ranch. Turn left and go to the upper use parking lot. Be there promptly at 10 a.m. and you must RSVP. I'll get to that again. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands in Santa Cruz. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80 as well as special group projects. Ask about that. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Probably not. This Saturday will be fine weather. Tools provided, bring gloves and water. You must RSVP for this weekend's habitat restoration on Saturday, January 9th at 10 a.m. at Wilder Ranch to Linda, 462-4041, or by email to REDWDRN, that's RedwoodRN, at PacBell.net. Or you can visit their webpage at www.cruisecnps.org. And unfortunately, a helicopter crash has killed three Department of Fish and Game biologists and a pilot in Madera County in California. Three Department of Fish and Game employees and a contract helicopter pilot died in a helicopter crash on Tuesday. They were on a routine aerial deer survey when the crash occurred in a remote section of Madera County. The investigation is underway to determine the cause of the crash. Clue Cotter, Department of Fish and Game associate biologist, 48 years old. Kevin O'Connor, Department of Fish and Game senior biologist supervisor, 40 years old. And Tom Stahlberg, Department of Fish and Game scientific aide, 31 years old. All of Fresno lost their lives in the helicopter crash. Helicopter pilot Dennis Mike Donovan of Landell's Aviation also lost his life. The families of the victims have been notified. We are deeply saddened at the loss of our esteemed colleagues, said John McCammon, director of Department of Fish and Game. Our employees are like family, and this sudden loss during a routine operation has left us stunned and with heavy hearts. California Department of Fish and Game annually conducts helicopter surveys to track trends in California deer populations. Surveys are conducted from the air because of cost effectiveness compared to ground surveys, access to remote locations, and to reduce bias compared to road-based observations. The Department of Fish and Game has grounded all helicopter surveys and captures until further notice. And in the big news this week, the Sea Shepherd goes on the offensive in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has escalated the battle to save the whales in the Southern Ocean, has outmaneuvered the Japanese security vessels, and is now in full pursuit of the Japanese whaling fleet. Captain Paul Watson is feeling more like an admiral this year. He is presently hundreds of miles from the frontline action that is taking place in Commonwealth Bay off the Adelie coast, as two of his three ships are in full pursuit of the Japanese whaling fleet. The Steve Irwin is expected to join the battle within 3 days, armed with a full load of fuel and fresh supplies, as the Japanese security ships search the seas to the north of the whaling fleet looking for the Steve Irwin. Sea Shepherd surprised the whalers with a ship the whalers were completely unaware of, the Bob Barker, a former Norwegian Antarctic whaling vessel, now turned Whale Defender. The Bob Barker, under Captain Chuck Swift, set out from Mauritius on December 18th on the long voyage across the bottom of the Indian Ocean. On the morning of January 6th at 0300 hours, they found the Nishin Maru and her four harpoon vessels. The Japanese whalers were completely caught off guard. Unaware, the Sea Shepherd now has three ships in the campaign this year. Joining the Bob Barker this morning was the fast patrol vessel Adel Gill out of New Zealand and skippered by Paul Bethune. The Bob Barker and the Adel Gill are chasing the Nishin Maru away from the whale sanctuary, and all whaling operations have been halted. Bear in mind, this particular press release came out a few days ago. The Japanese strategy was to keep the Steve Irwin away from the fleet by dedicating a faster ship to tail the Sea Shepherd crew. Using aerial surveillance, the Japanese located the Steve Irwin on December 9th at the 200-mile limit off the Australian coast. They relayed that information to the waiting Shonan Maru No. 2. 6 hours later, the faster Japanese vessel intercepted the Steve Irwin, making it impossible for the Sea Shepherd crew to locate the main body of the Japanese fleet. Attempts to lose the tail were unsuccessful, forcing Captain Watson to return to Tasmania, where he refueled and then departed under cover of a storm on the evening of December 31st. Despite the Japanese sending multiple surveillance planes up all day on January 1st, the Steve Irwin slipped past the Japanese security vessel Yushun Maru undetected. The Shonan Maru No. 2 had returned to the fleet to refuel and was replaced at the 200-mile limit by the Yushun Maru. The objective of the Sea Shepherd's three-ship campaign is to bankrupt the illegal Japanese whaling fleet and to sink them economically. This year I have three ships, four small boats, a jet ski, a helicopter, 77 five-person crew and a bag full of aggravation for the Japanese whale poachers, said Captain Paul Watson. We intend to make life miserable for the whale killers over the next month and a half. Included in the crew is the Animal Planet crew filming the third season of the hit television series Whale Wars. The Sea Shepherd crew numbers 77 from 16 nationalities, including Australia, Brazil, Canada, Ecuador, Estonia, France, Germany, Ghana, Hungary, Ireland, Japan, Netherlands, New Zealand, South Africa, Sweden, United Kingdom, and the United States. The next press release from yesterday. Japanese whalers ram Sea Shepherd 80 gill. Famed trimaran is sinking in the Southern Ocean. Six crew members rescued by the Sea Shepherd ship Bob Barker. In an unprovoked attack, captured on film, the Japanese security ship Shonan Maru No. 2 deliberately rammed and caused catastrophic damage to the Sea Shepherd trimaran 80 gill. Six crew members, four from New Zealand, one from Australia, and one from the Netherlands, were immediately rescued by a crew from the Sea Shepherd ship Bob Barker. None of the 80 gill crew were injured. The 80 gill is believed to be sinking, and chances of salvage are very slim. According to eyewitness Captain Chuck Swift on the Bob Barker, the attack happened while the vessels were dead in the water. The Shonan Maru No. 2 suddenly started up and deliberately rammed the 80 gill, ripping 8 feet off the bow of the vessel. According to Captain Swift, the vessel does not look like it will be saved. The Japanese whalers have now escalated this conflict very violently, said Captain Paul Watson. If they think that our remaining two ships will retreat from the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary in the face of their extremism, they will be mistaken. We now have a real whale war on our hands, and we have no intention of retreating. Captain Paul Watson on board the Steve Irwin is racing towards the area at 60 knots, but still remains some 500 miles away. The Bob Barker has temporarily stopped the pursuit of the Nishin Maru to rescue the crew of the 80 gill. The Japanese ships initially refused to acknowledge the Mayday distress call of the 80 gill, but ultimately did acknowledge the call. Despite acknowledging the call, they did not offer to assist the 80 gill or the Bob Barker in any way. And that's contrary to international maritime regulations. If you hear a Mayday, you must respond. Back to the press release. The incident took place at 64 degrees 3 minutes south, 143 degrees 9 minutes east. Until this morning, the Japanese were completely unaware of the existence of the Bob Barker. This newest addition to the Sea Shepherd fleet left Mauritius off the coast of Africa on December 18th and was able to advance along the ice edge from the west as the Japanese were busy worrying about the advance of the Steve Irwin from the north. This is a substantial loss for our organization, said Captain Watson. The 80 gill, the former Earth race, represents a loss of almost $2 million vessel. However, the loss of a single whale is of more importance to us, and we will not lose the 80 gill in vain. This blow simply strengthens our resolve. It does not weaken our spirit. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society is requesting that the Australian government send a naval vessel to restore the peace in the waters of the Australian Antarctic Territory. We have a 77-person crew from 16 nations. Six of them were on the 80 gill. Of these, 21 are Australians, blah, blah, blah. Sea Shepherd believes the Australian government has a responsibility to protect the lives of Australian citizens working to defend whales from illegal Japanese whaling activities. Quote, Australia needs to send a naval vessel down here as soon as possible to protect both the whales and the Australian citizens working to defend these whales, unquote, said Steve Irwin. Chief Cook Laura Dakin of Canberra, quote, this is Australian Antarctic territorial waters and I see the Japanese whalers doing whatever they want with impunity down here without a single Australian government vessel anywhere to be found. Peter Garrett, I have one question for you. Where the bloody hell are you? Unquote. And today, the unfortunate news, the rammed vessel 80 gill has sunk. On January 8th, at 2010 at 1720 GMT, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society vessel Bob Barker reported the last known position of another Sea Shepherd vessel, the 80 gill, to the Australian Rescue Coordination Center. This report was made because the 80 gill, which was originally going to be towed to a nearby base, is now sinking and could pose a navigation hazard for the next 2 or 3 hours. Having barely survived a vicious attack by the illegal Japanese whaling vessel Shonan Maru No. 2 on January 6th, the 80 gill began taking on water. Since that time, Bob Barker crew members have been working around the clock in an attempt to save the ship and remove possible environmental hazards in case the vessel had further complications while being towed. During the final towing attempt, the ropes holding the 80-gallon place behind the Bob Barker snapped, seemingly the result of water accumulating in the vessel. Upon examination, the 80-gill was found to be approximately 30% submerged, including the engine room and main fuel tanks. Fortunately, all fuel and lubricants had been removed from the 80-gill hours earlier. Bob Barker's call to the ARCC fulfilled Sea Shepherd's legal reporting requirements for this incident, but not its obligation to protect whales from illegal Japanese fleet that is killing whales illegally in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. The Bob Barker will now rejoin the Steve Irwin in pursuit of the whaling fleet to continue defending the whales. And in a follow-up story, Australia and New Zealand investigating whaling crash. Australia joined New Zealand on Thursday in investigating a clash between anti-whaling protesters and Japanese whalers, but refused to send a patrol ship to Antarctic waters as activists promised a whale war. Canberra called for calm on all sides after the hardline Sea Shepherd Conservation Society's futuristic powerboat 80 Gill had its bow sliced off in a collision with the Japanese ship shown on Maroon No. 2 on Wednesday and was left foundering in frigid seas. "It concerns me deeply. It's clear that emotions are running high and that lives are at risk," Australia's acting Prime Minister Julia Gillard told reporters. "It seems miraculous to me, having seen the video, that lives were not lost." And you can find that video online. Just search for 80 Gill, A-D-Y-G-I-L. Yeah, New Zealand, where the 80 Gill was registered, has already launched an investigation into the clash, and Gillard said Australia's maritime safety body would undertake a second probe that could lead to court if either side were found at fault. In Tokyo, a Japanese government spokesman said an official protest had been lodged with New Zealand's government. "The Japanese government sees this as extremely regrettable," said Chief Cabinet Secretary Hirofumi Hirano. "Confrontations between whalers and opponents have become an annual feature of the hunt in Antarctic waters claimed by Australia, but not recognized as Australian by Japan." Gillard said the accident occurred just outside Australia's economic zone. Sea Shepherd founder Paul Watson, who Japan has previously called an eco-terrorist, said he wanted protection from Australia's Navy for his protest fleet, now reduced to two ships. "We now have a real whale war on our hands, and we have no intention of retreating," Watson said. Environmentalists accuse Australia of going soft on threats of an International Court of Justice whaling challenge to avoid damaging Canberra's $58 billion trade relationship with Japan. Australian opposition and green lawmakers demanded the government send a custom ship to the area to ease tensions. "These are Australian waters. Australia has not only the right but an obligation to be policing them," said Australian Greens leader Bob Brown. Canberra sent a customs icebreaker to Antarctic waters in early 2008 to monitor the Japanese whaling fleet and gather photographic and video evidence for a legal case, but Gillard said Australia would not be sending a patrol ship again, saying the 2008 move had failed to influence behavior. Both countries have in the past agreed to quarantine their differences over whaling from wider diplomatic relations in order to avoid damaging close security ties and long-running free trade talks. Australia has managed to protect its major trade ties in Asia from periodic bilateral tensions, most notably the detention of an Australian mining executive in China in 2009. Japan's fisheries agency said the collision took place when 80 Gill suddenly slowed down as it crossed in front of Shonan Maru, which had warned the boat of impending danger. That's not what you see on the film, though. All six crew were rescued from the 80 Gill, but the clash left one activist with two broken ribs and a $1.5 million carbon fiber trimaran foundered. Sea Shepherd expected the powerboat to be unsalvageable, and it has apparently sank. New Zealand Foreign Minister Murray McCulley, said sending an Australian patrol ship would not lead to automatic restraint. "People are going to behave badly down there. It's not much we can do about it," McCulley told Australian radio. Law expert Don Rothwell said if the Japanese captain was found at fault, legal proceedings could likely occur in New Zealand. Concerns could also be raised by the London-based International Maritime Organization following reports the Japanese vessel fled after the collision, said Rothwell from the Australian National University. Commercial whaling was banned under a 1986 moratorium, but Japan continues to cull whales, saying it is for research purposes, deflecting criticism from anti-whaling nations. Japan says whaling is a cultural tradition, and while most Japanese do not eat whale meat regularly, many are indifferent to accusations that the hunting is cruel. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign update from the field. Happy New Year to all our Buffalo friends. It has been a good start to the new decade for the Buffalo. Things have remained quiet in the field, and save for one bull bison killed on Horse Butte, Montana's bison hunt has been uneventful this year. After an unseasonably dry beginning, the snow has finally started falling in earnest. Over the course of the last 2 days, we've gotten nearly 2 feet. While breathtakingly beautiful, the snow definitely brings challenges, especially if it falls all at once. We are spending lots of time plowing and shoveling around our headquarters. Our snowplow is really old, but it's holding up and helping to clear paths so our two barely working patrol vehicles can make it down the driveway to transport volunteers into the field. Patrols must now ski or snowshoe to get around or risk being immediately exhausted by post-holing through the deep cold powder. Our supply of skis has been used well over the last 13 seasons in the field, which means lots of wear and tear and want for working equipment. Snow may also inspire the buffalo to migrate to lower elevation lands, so we are keeping close watch along Yellowstone's boundary throughout the buffalo's migration corridors. We are constantly reminded of how very lucky we are to keep company with buffalo, elk, moose, eagles, ravens, coyotes, fox, and the many other Yellowstone's ecosystem's amazing creatures. Last week during a trek into Yellowstone, patrols were blessed with a rare and remarkable experience. They came across the fresh carcass of an old bull elk that had just been taken by wolves. Patrols were able to spot one of the wolves before it quickly retreated into the willows. The tracks surrounding the elk offered a rare, storied gift of the dramatic life and death dance so rich in nature's poetry of expression. Wolf song has also been heard from the cabin, which is a thrill of mystery to everyone. We are so blessed to live among these wonderful wild creatures and give thanks every day for their continued existence. And skis and ski boot donations are needed. Winter has arrived in earnest and has delivered several feet of snow in a very short amount of time. Skiing and snowshoeing is a must now, and our supply of skis and ski boots are old and quickly reaching the point of disrepair, which is preventing some folks from getting out into the field. If you can help us with skis, the 3-pin Nordic Standard are best, or ski boots, 3-pin or and the larger sizes especially, please contact our gear coordinator Lobo at gear@buffalofieldcampaign.org. That email address, gear@buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is always in need of certain items, so please check our wish list on the webpage for items you may be able to help us with. Donations, in-kind or monetary, are tax-deductible and very much appreciated. Here's the address for sending all that stuff. Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Once again, the address, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you're going to go up there and join, please visit their webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org to read all about how to become and how to act while a Buffalo Field Campaign volunteer. And before you go, give them a call at 406-646-0070. That number again, 406-646-0070. And do remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And comments are needed on Buffalo Giveaway. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has released a draft environmental assessment on the translocation of quarantined Yellowstone bison and is seeking your input until January 12, 2010. It's coming up in a few days, so it's time to get your comments in. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks preferred alternative outlines the agency's intention to hand over 74 Yellowstone bison to billionaire Ted Turner, setting a dangerous precedent of commercializing public bison. The Buffalo Field Campaign has strongly opposed quarantine, alternatively advocating for wild bison to be naturally restored on their historic range via protected habitat and migration corridors. That said, it is important that bison advocates try to help these quarantined Yellowstone buffalo get out of captivity and be released onto public and/or tribal lands, as was the stated goal of the quarantine feasibility study. Comments are needed by January 12th. You can mail your comments to Bison Translocation, Wildlife Division, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, P.O. Box 200701, Helena, Montana 59620. Once again, that address for your comments before January 12th are Bison Translocation, Wildlife Division, Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, P.O. Box 200701, Helena, Montana 59620. Or you can send email to QFBison, that's QFBISON, at mt.gov. And thank you so much for being a voice for America's last population of buffalo. And again, you can get more information about this at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And here locally, Pacific Grove tree trimming may have caused a low monarch turnout. In this story by Kara Abraham of the Monterey County Weekly. The Pacific Grove Monarch Sanctuary is low on butterflies this year, and I believe that the Natural Bridges butterflies are pretty low also. And some monarch enthusiasts suspect that a late September trimming of eucalyptus branches is to blame. I visited the Monarch Grove Sanctuary in Pacific Grove yesterday and was shocked to see many of the upper branches of the main eucalyptus cluster tree grove had been cut off, wrote El Dorado entomologist Paul Cherubini at a Monarch listserv. I could hardly believe my eyes because it was obvious to me this amount of pruning will substantially degrade the suitability of the sanctuary as a cluster site, and the butterfly population is likely to be substantially lower and less stable this year and for years to come. Pacific Grove Public Works Director Celia Perez Martinez said the trimmings was done for public health and safety. Eucalyptus trees are very vulnerable to limb breakage, she said. In 2004, an 85-year-old woman was killed by a falling branch while visiting the sanctuary. The city settled with her family for $1 million. In late September, before the official October 1st start of the monarch season, city arborist Rick Caton directed a tree service on which branches to cut, Perez Martinez said. The city did not generate a report to document the work. In the future, we'll do that, but we've never done it in the past, she said. The low butterfly numbers could be caused by a number of things, she added, including the fall's heavy rains and huge windstorm. They could have gone to Santa Cruz for all we know, she said, and they're not here, according to a butterfly visitor that I'm aware of. Dr. Francis Villablanca of Cal Poly is tasked with reviewing the monarch count data. At the current time, we do not know if the Pacific Grove Sanctuary population count is low because of something peculiar to this site, tree trimming, or if the populations are low range-wide and across all sites, he wrote in an email to Perez Martinez. Within the next few weeks, Villablanca expects to have the data to reach some conclusions. I would call for calm minds to prevail until we have some data, he wrote. The story will then be self-evident. And let's see if I can find a short one here. Even at sub-lethal levels, pesticides may slow the recovery of wild salmon populations. Exposure to common pesticides may hinder the growth and survival of endangered species Act listed salmon. Biologists determined that short-term seasonal exposure to pesticides in rivers and basins may limit the growth and size of wild salmon populations. In addition to the widespread deterioration of salmon habitats, these findings suggest that exposure to commonly used pesticides may further inhibit the recovery of threatened or endangered populations. Major efforts are currently underway to restore Pacific salmon habitats in an effort to recover depressed populations, says David Baldwin of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, who co-authored the study with NOAA colleagues in the December issue of the ESA journal Ecological Applications. However, not much research has been done to determine the importance of pollution as a limiting factor of ESA-listed species, unquote. The researchers studied the impact of pesticides such as diazinon and malathion on individual salmon using pre-existing data, and then devised a model to calculate the productivity and growth rate of the population. They used several exposure scenarios to reflect realistic pesticide use across various landscapes and over time. Pesticides include insecticides, herbicides, and fungicides that are usually applied to agricultural and urban landscapes. They primarily enter waterways as spray drift, surface runoff, and irrigation return flows. An important aim of the work was to link known sublethal effects for individual salmon to impacts on the productivity of salmon populations, explained Baldwin. The biologist found that previous studies on an individual level, the pesticides directly affected the activity of acetylcholine esterase, an important enzyme in the salmon brain. As a result, the salmon experienced reductions in feeding behavior. The reductions in food were then extended using a model to calculate reductions in growth, size, and subsequent survival at ocean migration. In one scenario, the model predicted that within a span of 20 years, returning spawners would have an increase of 68% abundance compared with a 523% projected increase in an unexposed Chinook population. The model showed that a pesticide exposure lasting only 4 days can change the freshwater growth and, by extension, the subsequent survival of subyearling animals, said Baldwin. In addition, the seasonal transport of pesticides to salmon habitats over successive years might slow the recovery of depressed populations. That's not good news. The researchers argued that improving water quality conditions by reducing common pollutants could potentially increase the rate of recovery. Looking to the bigger picture, this should help resource managers consider pesticides at the same biological scale as physical and biological stressors when prioritizing habitat restoration activities, said Baldwin. And we want to thank Nadine Lim, Director of Public Affairs for the Ecological Society of America, for providing us with that story. And that's it for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is broadcast every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 and www.freakradio.org. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast or a podcast of this broadcast, you can go to www.h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio, and a variety of former programs will be available for your listening pleasure. And we thank the folks at h2opodcast.com for providing and recording those broadcasts. Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We urge you to tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another Earth First Update.